I'd like to preface my remarks with a message from the University Fire Marshal. The no smoking regulations will be in effect during the lecture, so please observe them. Welcome to the colloquy, Sexuality, A Search for Perspective. The topic for this week has been sexuality and the law, for which this will be the final lecture. Next week's topic, premarital sexual standards and behavior, will be discussed by Drs. Ira Reese, Albert Ellis, and Mrs. Sidney Callahan. The colloquy as a whole is attempting to provide speakers of divergent backgrounds and viewpoints. In order for you to get the full perspective, we would prefer that you attend various lectures under each topic so that you may realize the full value and intent of the search for perspective. To entertain only those ideas with which you have previously agreed is to negate the whole purpose of education. We therefore ask both your attendance and your full attention at these lectures. Introducing our speaker today will be Dr. William B. Weil. Dr. Weil is the chairman of the Department of Human Development of the College of Human Medicine. Prior to coming to MSU in 1968, Dr. Weil was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University, an assistant professor at Western Reserve University, and professor and acting chairman of the Department of Pediatrics, University of Florida College of Medicine. He is president-elect of the National Society for Pediatric Research and an A.I. DuPont professor for handicapped children. Dr. Weil.
As chairman of the Department of Human Development, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce our guest today, Dr. Guttmacher, who will be 71 in May, but you could never tell that by talking with him or seeing him, had his medical training at Johns Hopkins and then later became chief of obstetrics at the Sinai Hospital in Baltimore, and in 1952 assumed the chairmanship of the Department of Obstetrics at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Since 1962, he has been with the Planned Parenthood organization. The Planned Parenthood organization has been working in the field of conception control for over 50 years. And I'd like to quote from an article about Dr. Guttmacher, which appeared in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine section. And in that article, the following statement was made. In the 6 years since Alan Guttmacher became head of Planned Parenthood World Population, its staff and budget have tripled, and it has grown from a struggling WASP-supported advisory service for the middle class into a slum-oriented mother church that supplies 472 Planned Parenthood clinics in the United States with medical scripture, proselytizing tracts, and an impressive armamentarium of contraceptive devices. They quote Dr. Guttmacher as saying, "I have the largest pill practice in the country," referring to the hundreds of thousands of women who receive birth control pills regularly in the Federation's clinics. Reminds me of a little line I heard yesterday. Somebody was talking about a young woman who was taking contraceptive pills and LSD together. She said she wanted to take a trip without the children. With that light note, I'd like to introduce a much more serious subject and introduce Dr. Guttmacher to you.
Madam Chairman, Dr. Weil, I'm very happy to be here at last. I had some difficulty because we had a snowstorm in New York and they wouldn't let us out. But I'm pleased to be here. And I've got a lot to say. It's a question whether I can cover the material I'd like to share with you in the limits of the hour, but we'll do our best. There seems to be a great deal of uncertainty as to who owns fertility. Does the state? Does the church? Does the individual? And I think that there has been a contest in this area, perhaps through the ages. Man has attempted from a personal point of view, to control his fertility from before recorded time. Birth control, contraception, is very ancient. The very earliest medical records we have, the famous Egyptian papyri, seven of them are concerned with obstetrics and gynecology. And the obstetrician, the priest physician of that day, knew a lot about birth control. So that this is not new. He knew a lot about abortion. This is not new. I think one may question as to why the church and the state have this investment in the reproductive potential of the human. Certainly in Judaism, it's clear to see that the Jewish religion has been concerned about fertility of its people, largely because they were a small nomadic group who had a great philosophical ideal, the ideal of monotheism, which they wanted to give to the world. And unless they grew vastly in number, they would be prey to the enemies and would disappear. The first of 613 commandments which Jehovah gave to his chosen people was, "Be ye fruitful and fill the earth." He didn't tell them what to do after they filled the earth. I think he might have some very good advice for them, but that's not in the Bible. As you know, contraception is damned in the Bible through the parable of Onan. I don't really think that it happened exactly as the Bible states in Genesis 38, verses 7 to 10, but I think it was a story, folklore, put in the Bible for a significant purpose. Now, the rabbis still feel that it probably was in order to compel the Jew to practice the levirate marriage. As you know, by Jewish law, if a man died childless, his brother had to marry the widow in order to bring up his seed. This was a kind of memorial to him. This was a perpetuation of his seed. I don't know whether that really is the reason or not. You see, the story is that Ur had two sons. One was Judah, and he sinned, and God was wroth, and he slew him. And quite logically, Judah said to Onan, "My boy, you have to marry your brother's widow." And I imagine she wasn't a very attractive dame. And I imagine Onan said, "Really, Papa?" And Papa stroked his beard and says, "Why, sure." And he married her. And then, of course, according to Jewish law, he must cohabit with her at least one Friday night a month. Well, the last Friday night of the month came around, and he cohabited with her, but probably in the process he said to himself, "I'll be damned if I want a child by this dame." And he withdrew and spilt his seed, and God was and he was wroth and he slew him. Now that, of course, is a story. The reason I don't think people were there, that it really happened, because I doubt if a large crowd was around to watch this event, and therefore I have some doubt that it actually occurred. Now, I think it probably came about in a little different way. I don't know. I have the idea that probably Aaron was sunbathing and Moses came along and saw his brother sleeping and kind of tickled him with his sandal and said, "How goes it, brother?" And I imagine Aaron looked up and said, "Well, Mo, I think as far as I'm concerned, everything's all right, but there are a few things I'd like to talk to you about. We never seem to have any chance to talk here on the desert. He said, well, brother, what's on your mind? He said, well, I'm concerned because we're not producing fast enough. Where the Halevis only have 2 children, the Bensians have 3 children, we can't make a nation. And Moses said, well, you know, I've never noticed that. He said, brother, how do you explain it? Well, Aaron said, it's pretty simple. The CIA tells me that they're spilling their seed upon the ground. And Moses said, most regrettable, most regrettable. He said, what do you think we ought to do about it? And Aaron said, I think we ought to put it in the Bible. So I think that is actually how the stricture against contraception came into Judaism, into the Bible. And it's been carried by Orthodox Judaism just as strongly as Catholicism, but people have strayed away from it. The Jew is a more practical man, the Orthodox Jew, than the Catholic, because under certain conditions, a Jewish woman, never a man, was allowed to practice contraception. There are 3 conditions the Talmud tells us in which contraception could be practiced. One, if the girl was very young. That means if she was less than 12 years and 1 day, she became a woman at 12 years and 1 day, but if she was less than that, she could practice contraception in marriage. Second, if she was already pregnant, because it was felt that another pregnancy would be a bad twin. You'd get a so-called fetus papyraceus in which one twin is normal and the other twin is simply like a dried up piece of paper. They thought this was due to conception occurring during pregnancy, which it is not due to. And also they thought that conception would dry up the mother's milk. So under these conditions, when you're very young, when you're pregnant, when you're nursing, contraception was all right. Now, I think I'd like to become more practical and perhaps talk about the origin of the democratization of birth control. You see, birth control was known by the elite, by the educated group throughout the world, that is in the educated world. The Egyptians knew it, the Greeks knew it, the Romans knew it, but it was only for the elite. It was not to be practiced by the simple common folk. It was believed that the rich get richer and the poor get children was an immutable law, handed down by God and could not be changed. Finally, a strange man came along, a fellow named Francis Place in England. I can't go into his biography because it's a fascinating story, but far too long. But nevertheless, he was a man who made breeches, and the best breeches in London, and he became very rich. He decided to become rich in a hurry because he wanted to retire at the age of 45, which he was able to do, to devote himself to much more important things than making the best breeches in London. And he became deeply concerned with social, economic problems of his day. And he thought that it was immoral for children to go to work as young as they did and to work as hard as they did in the mills of the Midlands, particularly. Because in 1823, when he first carried out his birth control campaign, the situation was somewhat better. Children were only allowed to work for 12 hours a day and only 7 days a week, so the situation had improved. But nevertheless, he felt that the fact that children could be put to work so rapidly in the factory, there were so many children, kept the labor market down, kept the wages down. And he felt that if there were fewer children, wages would go up and they wouldn't have to go to work so early in the factory and they could get a better secular and religious education. And therefore, he went around through the Midlands and London and other parts of England and distributed his so-called devilish hand bills, in which he exhorted the poor to use birth control. And he prescribed a method of cutting a piece of sponge into about the size of a small apple and putting a string about it, inserting it in the vagina before coitus was practiced, and in this way preventing the semen from entering the mouth of the uterus, the cervix, and therefore preventing pregnancy. It was not too good a method, but it was about the best method available. This made quite an impression. He did not get any trouble himself, but some of the people who handed out the handbills were arrested and brought before magistrates. So then, even then, in England, this was not looked upon with favor by the state. Now, why does the state have such a vested interest in one's fertility? Well, before the day of modern nuclear war, vast armies were of significant political importance, and they needed cannon fodder and soldiers. A big nation was a powerful nation. Therefore, they must grow. They must have cannon fodder. Now the situation has changed so utterly and so completely with the technical knowledge and power of a country outweighing so much its muscle strength that the situation is not as it was. And I think that the state probably is losing interest in size. Certainly some states realize quite well they're oversized. Fortunately, mainland China, among other states. Now, the democratization of birth control is a long story, but the American saga is a very interesting one because Margaret Sanger, who is known to all of you, she was this remarkable woman who was from a small town in upper New York, a nurse by profession, a mother of three children, decided that she would devote her life to the goal of bringing birth control to simple folk. According to her biography, her conversion occurred in a rather dramatic way. She was a nurse on the east side of New York in the Grand Street area, and she was making her rounds as a visiting nurse when a distraught man came down and intercepted her and pled with this young and beautiful red-headed, white, very, very alabaster-skinned woman to climb up the five flights to the tenement which he occupied with his wife and their four children. She got there and found Sadie Sachs, the wife, desperately ill from an abortion which either she had committed on herself or had been committed. And Margaret, with the help of a physician, was able to nurse Mrs. Sachs back to health. And after 3 weeks, when this woman was greatly improved, the physician and Mrs. Sanger made a last visit on the patient. And Margaret says in her biography that Sadie, with her large brown eyes, looked at the doctor and said, "Doctor, tell me how not to get pregnant." This was 1912, USA. And the doctor said, "Oh, tell Jake to sleep on the roof." That was all the birth control available for the poor in 1912. Well, this made an impression on Mrs. Sanger. This is reinforced 6 months later when she was summoned to the same tenement on the same mission, but with an entirely different ending, because 10 minutes after Margaret reached the flat of the Saxes, Mrs. Sachs died in her arms. And according to her biography, this November night she walked the streets of New York to 3 o'clock in the morning protesting the elimination of this extraordinarily valuable life. And she made up her mind then that she would direct her career toward bringing birth control to those who need it most and knew at least the poor, the unsophisticated. This very remarkable woman, as you know, opened the first birth control clinic in Brooklyn in 1916. She could not get a doctor to serve in the clinic the first week because this was anathema. Any doctor who would work in birth control was looked upon as a kind of a scoundrel. And Margaret and her sister got 400 histories from neighborhood women who sought birth control advice from this clinic. And after the clinic had been operating for a week, they also saw a little pamphlet about birth control. A policewoman walked in disguise, bought the pamphlet for 50 cents, blew her whistle, the cops came in, took all of the records out in the street, made a bonfire at the intersection of two streets in Brooklyn. And of course, Margaret went to jail for the first time in her career, the first of 8 times in her career. Now, of course, the whole situation has changed so completely, so utterly, so magnificently. Now, the change, of course, is from the medical profession, from the legal profession, from the point of view of the populace. As you know, we had some damnable laws called the Comstock Laws in this country, which were put on the books by Anthony Comstock, who was a professional do-gooder. He was something secretary of the Watch and Ward Society, the social hygiene, I can't remember what they called this organization, but he was going around harassing people by making them better. And Anthony Comstock got this law passed through the Congress. This then prevented the importation of birth control supplies from abroad. It prevented interstate commerce. And then each state that was seduced by this man, passed little Comstock Acts, and we had a network then of states with little acts until you, for instance, in Connecticut, not only you couldn't sell, display, advise, but you couldn't even use contraception in the state of Connecticut. There were obviously more felons in Connecticut each night than, you can count the numbers. But this was the stupid, silly law. Now, this remained on the books. And then in 1936, Dr. Hannah Stone imported 3 diaphragms, contraceptive diaphragms from Japan, notified the government that she was importing these, sought arrest, was arrested, and of course was tried. And this is known as the U.S. versus one package, the package of diaphragms. So if you're a lawyer, want to look it up, you have to look it up under U.S. versus one package. And of course, she was found not guilty by the famous Justice Leonard Hand, Augustus Hand, his cousin, and a Justice Moskowitz in the Appellate Court of New York found her not guilty, Dr. Stone. And this did a great deal to soften the impact of our restrictive laws, because most of the states decided that they would repeal the little Comstock Acts as long as a federal law was non-operative, except for Connecticut and Massachusetts. And of course, in Connecticut, we finally won the victory in the Supreme Court decision of July 7th, 1965, by a 7-2 decision of the court. The two justices, Stewart and Black, who were negative, who were the two votes against the finding the law unconstitutional, said the laws were silly, but the legislatures should repeal them and not the Supreme Court should find them unconstitutional, because in their point of view, no constitutional amendment was abrogated through these laws. The 7 justices who found favorable verdict thought that there was something under the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 9th amendments which were abrogated by such silly laws. So now we have this whole boogaboo dispelled. So that's gone. There's no law which prevents contraception over the country anyplace. Now, as far as the appreciation is concerned, we have extraordinary appreciation by the medical profession. In 1959, the Public Health Association passed a stunning resolution, and the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the psychiatric, so forth and so on. So that the medical profession has now finally, long late, risen to the importance of contraception. And of course, the federal government has greatly involved itself. We had no money from government in contraception until 3 years ago. But beginning then, through the poverty program and through HEW and through AID, we have gotten, even in a budget-cutting year, increasing allotments. In budget 1967, OAO had $2.5 million for birth control. In budget year 68, they had $9.5 million for birth control. In budget year 69, they'll have $13 million for birth control. HEW increased its allotment from $18 million budget 68 to $31.5 million in budget 69. AID increased its allotment from $35 million in budget 68 to $50 million in budget 69. So there is no question about not only where the medical profession stands, but where the government stands. I cannot go into all the evidence, but you can read in pamphlets published by your government the statement that the most cost-effective dollar in the war on poverty is the birth control dollar. The most cost-effective dollar in the war on poverty is the birth control dollar. And then you'll read that if we are trying to reduce infant mortality, which we are trying to do in this country because we stand quite low down among the great nations of the world when it comes to infant mortality, we are told by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare that the most effective way to reduce infant mortality is through effective contraception. The reason is that there is a much higher death rate among children born to mothers, that is during the first year of life, born to mothers when they have had more than four. The death rate goes up quite precipitately. And since most American women, irrespective whether they're poor, rich, middle class, want between two and four children. Actually, the poor want someone less than those well-to-do. If we could help the poor achieve the four-child family, we would obviously cut down infant mortality in a rather dramatic fashion. So that there is everything going for the approval of birth control. Now, what about birth control for the unmarried? Well, we were sticky about this thing. Not only we, but the government was. When they first became interested in the Department of Welfare, for instance, Illinois, they restricted birth control only to married women. This, of course, is absurd and ridiculous, because if you're trying to cut down the illegitimacy rate, if you're trying to reduce the roles of the AFCD, then you've got to do something to try to bring pregnancy into proper perspective and make of it a positive thing. People should assume the frame of mind that unless pregnancy is desired, then under all other conditions, birth control, effective birth control should be used. And this must include not only the married, but the unmarried as well. I am not a moralist. I'm not here talking about a moral code. I'm certainly not trying to in any way uphold the propriety and necessity for premarital intercourse. It's here. And as long as it's here, whether we old people approve of it or not, is not so important as to protect the young who indulge in it. And certainly, the cruelest thing is an unwanted pregnancy from an unmarried alliance. It's not only cruel for the child, because it's cruel, of course, for the two people involved. And therefore, we do believe strongly that birth control must be offered to the unmarried as well as the married. Now, abortion. You had a very learned discussion of abortion by Professor Noonan, whom I admire vastly. He is one of the great scholars. I am presenting quite a different point of view from Professor Noonan, because I have a different background. I belong to a different religion. And I think it's probably timely for you to get different points of view. Abortion, according to the World Health Organization, is probably the most serious endemic disease that faces the world today. World Health Organization estimates there are 25 million illegal abortions performed in the world every year. There are 125 million children born and 25 million abortions. This is an estimate. It may be higher, it may be lower. But we know in the United States It's probably the third largest racket. First, of course, is gambling. Second, narcotics. And third, of course, is abortion. We don't know at all how many illegal abortions are done in the United States each year. The guess has been anywhere from 200,000 to 1.5 million. We usually choose the figure 1 million. It's simple to say. It's easy to visualize. But it's a large number. Now, are we happy with this? Of course not. It's dangerous. Fortunately, not so dangerous as it was before antibiotics and transfusion, so that probably the deaths from abortion in this country are now reduced to someplace under 500 per year, which is a great improvement over yesteryear when the numbers were probably 5,000. It causes a great deal of physical and psychic illness. Now, the question is, what do we do about it? Well, as you know, we have illegal abortion, and then we have what is called legal or therapeutic abortion. Legal or therapeutic abortion. You see, the laws in our 50 states, until very recently, were practically all the same. They were copied after the English law of 1803, which was modified in 1860. And the laws read that abortion may be done to preserve the life of the mother. Now, in some states, it was to promote the safety and various verbiages, but for all practical purposes, the laws were the same. If pregnancy in the eyes of the physician was likely to cause death of the woman, it could be legally interrupted. How common is legal abortion in the United States? Until very recently, there were approximately between 7,000 and 8,000 legal abortions done in this country every year, and 1 million illegal abortions done in this country. Who were having the legal abortions? A much higher incidence among the well-to-do than the poor. We find in the proprietary hospitals of New York, these are the small private hospitals, the abortion rate was 3.9 per 1,000 births. We find in the voluntary hospitals, the large hospitals like New York Hospital, Presbyterian, Mount Sinai, the rate was 2.4 per 1,000 live births on the private service and 0.5 on the clinic service of the same great hospitals. We find that in the municipal hospitals of New York, the rate was 0.1. That is one abortion per 10,000 births. Now, obviously, the woman going to the proprietary hospital isn't 40 times as ill as the woman who goes to the municipal hospital. It's purely a matter of pocketbook, influence. It's highly discriminatory. What about the illegal abortion? You can buy a safe abortion if you've got $1,000. You can almost have a guarantee that everything will go well. If you've got $3, it'll go badly, because either you've got to do the darn thing yourself or get some neighbor in, or I guess $3 wouldn't get you any kind of a job from anybody. Maybe it's 7 or 10, I don't know what it is. But you can get some old granny to do it, and badly. Who die from abortions? Well, we find in New York City that the non-white death rate from abortion is 5 times the white rate. We find that in New York City, the death rate in the Puerto Rican group is 26 times the death rate in the white rate. We find in California that the women who have abortions, 63% have had 4 or more pregnancies. The women who die are the poor. Women who have had a house full of children and rebel, not because they don't love kids. They rebel because they know darn well that they have no home, no economy, no pocketbook, no chance to take care of another child and do a job. We all want to be good parents. This is not unique in you and me.
Everybody wants to be a good parent. And sometimes we analyze the situation and rebel and say, you can't be a good parent to a child that's not wanted and we can't possibly take care of. And these are the people who end on the autopsy table. Now, your grand dame, who's a kept woman by the president of some great commercial organization, she's going to be in great shape. Because, hell, he can spill $1,000 or $10,000 and get an abortion in Japan, or he can get a good abortion someplace in the United States. So that legal abortion and illegal abortion are extraordinarily discriminatory. And this is what I object to. Now, I don't favor abortion. My own feeling is that contraception, preventing pregnancy by effective contraception, is far wiser physically, psychologically, ethically, than doing abortion. But at the same time, if we can't stop this racket, we've got to do something to at least take out the discrimination and promote the safety. Now, what's been done? 5 of our states have modified their highly restrictive statute, which said that abortion may be done only to preserve the life of the mother. These states are Colorado, North Carolina, California, Georgia, and Maryland. Many states, including Michigan and New York, are considering how to modify their current abortion statute. In 1959, the American Law Institute proposed a model penal code. This chapter on abortion was written in 59, largely, I believe, by Wexler, was one of the authors of it. And as you know, this is a bad law. Because it says, number one, abortion may be done to preserve the life and health of the mother. This is interpreted to mean not only her physical health, but her mental health as well. Number two, abortion may be done if there is serious likelihood of the child being born malformed. Three, abortion may be done if the pregnancy is a result of rape or incest. Now, this statute was taken in toto by Colorado. This statute was taken in toto by California. I'm sorry, California excluded the abnormal child. It took simply the health and life of the mother and rape and incest. It was taken in toto by Georgia. Now, I've been in correspondence in preparation for my discussion with you, with people in these areas. And I'm told by my informants, Dr. Overstreet tells me that in California in 1968, they will have increased their legal abortions from 500 previous to the modification of the law to 6,000. That is then 12 times. Dr. Overstreet tells me that the estimate of illegal abortion in California is between 50,000 and 100,000 per year. 80,000 is probably a more realistic figure. Therefore, what have you done? Damn little. After all, what you've done then is to increase your abortions by 5,500. But you've still got a cesspool of some 74,000 illegal abortions being done. You're still having discrimination, because even the legal abortions in California are discriminatory. The rich who are sophisticated and get a good psychiatrist have a much better chance of getting an abortion in California than those perhaps who need it the most. 85% of the 6,000 abortions done in California were done for psychiatric reasons. I'm not saying that's a wrong thing to do. But I'm trying to tell you that psychiatric reasons can be stretched like a rubber band. And therefore, if you've got the right psychiatrist and the right financial backing to stretch it, you can get quite a distance. 7% were done for health. And the few remaining percentages were for incest, rape. Now, obviously in California, when you cannot do abortions because of the child, because of German measles, then, of course, you do find that many of the abortions for eugenic reasons will be done on a psychiatric indication. In other words, if you have rubella, German measles early in pregnancy, and you know that your chance of having an abnormal child, if you have it in the first month of pregnancy, is something like 50%. Obviously, this is a great emotional psychic strain on you, and I would authorize you to be aborted on psychiatric grounds as long as I don't have the eugenic grounds. And therefore, some of these 88% are obviously on the basis of eugenic indication. Maryland is the only state that's shown any real guts in this thing. And Maryland has removed abortion from the criminal code. There's nothing in the statutes of Maryland about abortion. They've put it under the Medical Practice Act, which means that the medical and chirurgical faculty, which is the state medical society, establishes the policy on abortion. We don't know how it's going to work in Maryland because it's very new. We haven't had a year's figures, and I cannot get you the information. There is still going to be a lot of illegal abortion, but not nearly as much as there probably is in California proportionately. Now, I was on the Governor's Commission in New York in order to frame and phrase a better abortion bill in New York, and I'm not happy about our bill. Our bill came out favoring abortion for preservation of life or health, for eugenic indications, for rape or incest, and for girls unmarried at the time, less than 14 years old, and for mothers of four children. This I put into it because that was the only way I could get at the economic and social factor that of the poor. Now, I would like to change that, and we have another bill in the legislature that Senator Burley has introduced. It probably won't pass, and this would be then life or health, eugenic reasons, rape or incest, any girl of less than 18 unmarried, any woman with four children, any woman who is 40 years or more. It seems to me by the time a woman reaches 40 years of age, she ought to be mature, and she ought to be able to make the proper decision as to whether or not another child would be a blessing in the household, whether they need it, whether they want it. And then I would have a woman aborted if she is incapable of taking care of a child because of either physical or mental reasons. Now, I don't do abortions lightly. I know that Professor Noonan feels quite strongly that you're taking a life. That's his point of view, and it's shared by a great many people. I don't look upon abortion as a form of murder at all. To me, there is no comparison between the rights of the adult individual and the family compared to some embryonic cells that have never become a human being, that are laid down according to the pattern of a human being, has had no human experiences, is not capable of thought. To me, this is quite different. This is not murder. This is simply balancing, in my point of view, the value of the adult life against a group of embryonic cells which have the potentiality of becoming a human being. You may say this is splitting hairs, this is semantics. This is not. This is simply the way I feel in the bottom of my gut. Now, I know that someday in America we shall have abortion on demand. It shall be the right of the individual to determine whether or not she remains pregnant. Not the right of the husband, not the right of the state, not the right of the church, the right of the woman. I think this is very sophisticated. I think it's very right. I don't think we're ready for it yet in this country. First of all, we can't get it. We're not going to get any legislature to do it. And I'm a pragmatist. I want to get as much as I can, and I don't want to shoot for the moon. when I can only go about 100 miles into the stratosphere. And therefore, I'm quite willing to have mock liberalization of our laws, perhaps on the Maryland pattern, provided we can cut down illegal abortion by as much, perhaps, as 50%. A word about sterilization. As you know, sterilization is very different than castration. So often the lay audience thinks that they're synonymous. Castration is removal of either the two testes in the male or the two ovaries in the female. Spaying, as you call it in your cat or your dog. Sterilization in the human nomenclature is usually accomplished by, in the male, by a very simple procedure called a vasectomy, in which one simply interrupts the passage of the sperm cells from the testes to the penis by cutting out and tying a segment of the vas deferens on either side, which goes through the upper part of the scrotum. I've seen it done many times in India. It's done under local anesthesia in very primitive hospitals. It's done extremely well. India reports 1,300,000 vasectomies in 1968. According to Chandra Sekhar, they hope to do 3 million vasectomies in the near future per year, because this is the great method of population control which the Indians are willing to accept. Now, in the woman, the procedure is more complicated. It's so-called tubectomy or salpingectomy, usually done by making an abdominal incision. It's most easily done immediately after childbirth, within the first 12 hours, when the uterus is high up in the abdomen and the fallopian tubes are very easily accessible. Then simply a segment of tube is taken out and tied, and that means that the sperm cell cannot get up to fertilize the egg, and the egg can't get down to meet the sperm cell. In the United States, we only have two states now with laws about sterilization. They are Utah and Connecticut. In these two states, sterilization may only be done if there is serious medical necessity, therefore. In all of the other 48 states, sterilization is legal for socioeconomic reasons. Now, the only thing that retards the progress of sterilization in this country is the conservatism of the medical profession. The doctor doesn't know his law. He's worried that he's not doing something which is legal, which of course is wrong, and he's a very conservative person at best. And the doctor's social conscience is a rather small organ, so that when it comes to the socioeconomic situation of his patients, he doesn't feel for them very often. Now, I don't think that sterilization should replace contraception, but I think that after the family is achieved, people have their 3 or 4 or 5 children that they desire, and they want an effective method of birth control which probably has the least worry about it, least concern, least necessity to carry out any kind of practice. Obviously, sterilization has an important place, and I think a place which we have neglected. In the United States, by the time the woman reaches 40 years of age, 10% of our marriages have been rendered sterile by surgical means. 8%, the woman has been sterilized. In half of the cases, in 4%, as a byproduct to a necessary gynecological procedure. In 4% of women in America, by the time the wife reaches 40, sterilization is done in order not to achieve another pregnancy, very often at the time of cesarean section. 2% of the husbands, by the time the wife has reached 40, have been sterilized in the United States. That's one man in 50. They're not, maybe two men in this room, there are 100 men here maybe, have been sterilized. Now, it's much more common on the West Coast, about 7% on the West Coast, and something less than 1% on the East Coast. But legally, we have no great roadblocks in regard to sterilization, as I said. It's largely the physician himself and the rules laid down by the particular hospital in which the doctor works. At Mount Sinai, it was a new concept when I went there in 1952. We introduced sterilization simply on the basis of the number of children which the woman had achieved. We sterilized any woman, irrespective of age, who had 6 living children. If she was 30 to 35, she must have 5 living children. If she was 35 or more, 4 living children. And this was known as the law from Mount Sinai. Now, this law has been modified by many other institutions. Now, they don't require quite as many children anymore, I think, even at Sinai. We've gotten a little more lenient and more progressive. Finally, I would like to talk just a moment about artificial insemination. As you know, about 10% of American marriages are barren. Perhaps 9%. We think it's come down from 11 to 10, and maybe even 9% of our marriages are involuntarily sterile. About half of the cases are due to problems in the male, and about half are due to problems in the female. Now, if the male is the cause of the infertility, then spermatozoa from a donor can be substituted, and in the wife impregnated very simply by simply collecting the semen, usually through masturbation, from a donor totally unknown to the wife but chosen by the physician carefully, and the semen injected in the vagina, and the chance for pregnancy is about the same as having coitus. Now, it's a fairly new technique. It was first used. There are cases of artificial insemination from the husband when intercourse is not possible. Sometimes the male has an abnormality of the penis, so-called hypospadias, in which his semen dribbles at the base of the penis instead of exiting from the end of the penis. And doing artificial insemination is quite useful in these cases. And the first case ever reported was done by John Hunter, the great English surgeon, from a husband with hypospadias in about 1795. But donor insemination is a relatively new thing. And in order to put a little levity into this solemn discussion, I'd like to tell you a small story. I'm afraid it won't have much impact because many of you know who Admiral Rickover is, but he's the hardest boiled admiral in the U.S. fleet. And everybody thinks he's an SOB, except for the people apparently who work for him who think he's Jesus Christ. But nevertheless, he's someplace in between the two, but nearer the SOB part. But he's a tough character. And 8 or 9 years ago, I was coming up from lunch in my office in Mount Sinai, and I heard my secretary say, well, just tell the admiral, Dr. Guttmacher's just coming in the office. I looked at this girl. I said, Admiral? She said, yes, Admiral Rickover wants to talk to you. I said, you're crazy. Admiral Rickover doesn't know me from a hill of beans. And I went to my office, and I thought some friend was playing a joke on me, and I picked up the telephone, and some sweet young voice said, just a moment, the Admiral will be here. So I had my telephone at about a normal distance. What do you know about semen banks? I said, well, Admiral, I knew then it was the Admiral. I said, I know that semen banks are possible. I said, but I don't have much stomach for this kind of wholesale artificial insemination. What do you know about freezing spermatozoa? So I said, well, I know you can freeze spermatozoa. You add 9% glycol and reduce them to minus 79 degrees, and you can keep them quite a long time. He said, my God, man, that's all you know, an atomic war coming? And I said, well, yes, sir. Yes, sir, that's all I know. He said, who knows more about this than you do? So I said, well, perhaps Dr. Muller, the Nobelist out at the University of Indiana. What a jackass I should have called him in the first place. That was the end of the total conversation between Rickover and Guttmacher. So that there is interest in artificial insemination, not only among sterile women, but among some great philosophers like Rickover. Now, of course, his interest is that if we have an atomic war, your gonads, both the males and females in the room, will be exposed to extraordinary radiation, which, of course, increases abnormal offspring in subsequent generations. Therefore, if we can collect semen from the most gallant-looking gentleman of this room and store it deep in the earth where they could not be then exposed to atomic radiation. Then, of course, we would only have half of our germplasm put awry by the atomic explosion. So Rickover wants to establish semen banks 2 miles below for a potential war. My enthusiasm for that is not very great. If we're going to be that crazy to have such a war, I think it's fine to see us extinguished totally and let amoebae rule the earth. But nevertheless, when it comes to the sterile woman, the sterile couple, artificial insemination has had an uncertain legal status. By some judges, it's been declared adultery, children illegitimate. By other judges, the child has been declared legitimate and the woman non-adulterous. By some judges, the child has been declared illegitimate, the woman not an adulteress. So the whole thing is terribly confused. Fortunately, we have finally some order out of the chaos. First of all, strange to say, Georgia, in 1964, in the legislature, passed a bill legalizing artificial insemination from the donor, provided that the wife and husband both sign consent. This is a very good statute. Amazing things come out of Georgia, in addition to Maddox. So that it's an excellent, excellent law. This has been copied by the Oklahoma legislature. We now have two states, Oklahoma in 67, Georgia in 64, in which artificial insemination by donor is not adultery, and the child is a fully legitimate child and has all the rights of a legitimate child. And finally, the Supreme Court of California in Sorensen versus the state has declared that a child conceived by artificial insemination, if the husband gives his consent, is completely a legitimate child. And the court has made fun and poked fun at this being adultery, because obviously this is the one way to achieve a pregnancy without adultery. It's the antithesis of adultery. And the court takes pains to point this out. So fortunately, from the point of view of progressive medicine, artificial insemination done under the proper auspices with consents is a perfectly legal procedure. Now, in the brief time available to me, I've tried to cover a great deal of ground. I'm rather disappointed that you won't be able to ask questions, because I'd hoped that some of the things which I left out of my discussion I could fill in that way. But nevertheless, it's been a great privilege to share this hour with you, and I thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Guttmacher, for a most interesting address. Thank you for your attendance.